even though those stimuli were emotionally neutral to begin with. Overcoming this collateral damage created accidentally requires rewiring the connections. The fear produced when Bridgeman felt that the bridge was about to split during the sudden storm had to be disconnected from bridges. Neither Bridgeman nor anybody else may be able to do this alone, but a first step is to understand how these fear-producing associations form and how they can be overcome. The goal becomes, in Bridgeman's problem, disassociating bridges from fear and reconnecting them with the pleasure of safely crossing to get to the other side. Absent an angel and a harp, or even a therapist, a friend could drive the fearful person first over very short bridges suspended just a few feet above shallow water, and then maybe before the day ends over larger, higher ones, perhaps while lovely harp music plays on the radio. The friend might then sit next to the fearful person while he takes the wheel and tries to drive first over the little bridges that span nearly dry land, and then gradually over bigger ones, high up above the water, as each bridge begins to feel safe again. This kind of desensitization allows us to escape stimulus control and restore self-control. It can free the paralyzed will. 17. Will fatigue. The exhausted audience was waiting for the program to start at the reception in the elegant Hungarian consulate on the Upper East Side of New York. It was late in the evening after a long work day. With a patron of the arts crowd, age 40-ish and much above, most in business attire, gray or black, re-examining Rolex watches and iPhones, eyes starting to close. After a long delay, amplified music suddenly burst forth, full blast. "I want to do the bad thing now, and I don't mind suffering later." The ragtag band on the stage screamed the words exuberantly, wildly playing fiddles and guitars, banging their drums and metal cans, shaking castanets and rattles, wearing tiny old fedora hats and hippie clothes, and flirting outrageously with one another and the very staid audience to promote tourism for Hungary. It electrified the dozing crowd, eliciting the excited cheering and roaring that might come from kids at a rock concert. If instead the program had begun with the expected video and lecture on the wonders of Budapest, the forced coughing fits and escapes toward the exit would soon have followed. Before the band stirred them up, the audience seemed to be having a bad case of collective will fatigue, tired from their own excessive exertion of self-control. Everyday willpower efforts, just to make it through a long and stressful workday, can be exhausting. They were primed to let the grasshoppers in them have some pleasure right now, and they were thrilled to accept the band's invitation to cut loose, have fun, and let the hot system enjoy while the overworked cool system took a break. The tired will. Are there limits to how much self-control and delay of gratification we can exert before will fatigue takes over? The concept of a fatigued will that becomes drained by its own excessive use is the basic idea underlying a current influential scientific theory on the nature of willpower and self-control. And it has important implications for how you think about your own ability to self-regulate. Roy Baumeister and his colleagues see willpower as a vital but limited biological resource that can easily be depleted for temporary periods. Their strength model of self-control proposes that self-control depends on some internal capacity that relies on a limited amount of energy. This is much like the traditional concept of the will as a fixed entity or essence. Some people have a lot of it, others very little. According to this model, self-control is like a muscle. When you actively exert volitional effort, ego depletion occurs, and the muscle soon becomes fatigued. Consequently, your willpower and ability to override impulsive behavior will temporarily diminish on a wide variety of tasks that demand self-control. This could affect everything from mental and physical endurance to rational thinking and problem-solving, from response inhibition and emotion suppression to making good versus bad choices. Suppose that you're famished and eager for a snack at the annual office reception. If you manage to forego the tempting, freshly baked chocolate chip cookies in front of you and instead make yourself stick to just the vegetable tray, the strength model suggests that immediately after this you will expend less effort on unrelated tasks that continue to require self-control. Evidence for this idea surfaced in a classic experiment that has become the prototype for studying ego depletion. College students taking introductory psychology at Case Western Reserve University in Ohio were required to participate in psychology experiments as part of their course, and those who went to Professor Baumeister's laboratory for their course requirement were put into the radish experiment. The students arrived hungry because they had been told to fast before coming. Once in the lab, they were asked to force themselves to forego the tempting chocolate chip cookies and candy and eat some radishes instead. Right after that, they were asked to work on geometry problems that were actually impossible to solve. The study showed that they quit much sooner than the students who had been allowed to eat the cookies and candy. In more than 100 other experiments, researchers demonstrated similar results. Engaging in self-control at time 1 reduced self-control at time 2, which immediately followed time 1. This was true no matter which act of self-control the students were instructed to perform. The results were the same whether they were stifling their emotional reactions to an intensely emotion-provoking film about what happens to wildlife in a nuclear wasteland, A Dog's World, originally titled Mondo Cane, or avoiding thoughts of white bears once primed to think of them. Try it if it sounds easy. Or reacting kindly to a partner's bad behavior. Mind over muscle. Students did indeed reduce their subsequent efforts in many studies like these, but later research showed that the reduced efforts were probably not caused by the reasons the researchers had initially assumed. As the demands for effortful self-control and tedious work escalated, but the incentives did not, the students' attention and motivation shifted. Rather than having their willpower muscles depleted, they probably became fed up, feeling that they had complied sufficiently with the experimenter's demands to do boring tasks. In one task, for example, after spending 5 minutes crossing out every E in a typewritten text, students then had to not cross out an E if it was followed by a vowel. And when people are given strong incentives to persist, even on tasks like that, they do continue longer. As motivation to exert self-control increases, effort continues. With no increase in motivation, it does not. In this interpretation, the reduction in self-control is not due to a loss of resources. It reflects instead changes in motivation and attention. The feeling of exhaustion, of being done in by effortful work, is real and anything but rare. Yet we also know that when sufficiently motivated, we can keep right on going, sometimes even with increasing zeal. When in love, we can go from experiencing an exhausting day or week or month to running eagerly to wherever our beloved is. For some people, feelings of fatigue become the cues not for turning on the television, but for jogging to the gym. The motivational interpretation of effortful persistence simply argues that mindsets, self-standards, and goals guide when we become invigorated rather than drained by our efforts, and when we need to relax, nap, self-reward, and allow the grasshoppers in us to emerge. If you believe that persisting on tough tasks is energizing rather than depleting, will it protect you from will fatigue? Indeed, yes. When people are led to think that effortful tasks will invigorate rather than drain them, they improve their performance on a later task. For example, when people were primed to believe that they would be energized by controlling their facial expressions so as not to show the emotions they were experiencing, they performed better on the later task of squeezing a hand grip. Their later performance was not impaired by the earlier effort, and their egos did not deplete. At Stanford University, Carol Dweck and her colleagues found that those who believed that their stamina fueled itself after tough mental exertion did not show diminished self-control after a depleting experience. In contrast, those who believed that their energy was depleted after a strenuous experience did show diminished self-control and had to rest to refuel. Dweck's team went on to track college students across 3 points in time, the last being their final exam period, which demanded strong self-regulation. Students who had an implicit theory of willpower as a non-limited resource fared much better during the high-stress exam period than those with a limited resource theory, who reported eating more unhealthy food, procrastinating more, and ineffectively regulating while trying to prepare for their tests. These findings underscore the importance of how we think about ourselves and our capacities for control, and they undermine the idea that our ability to exert effort in pursuit of goals is an immutable, biologically driven process. When you control the treats, self-reward standards. It does not take experiments or philosophers to know that an excess of will can be as self-defeating as its absence. Always postponing gratification and continuously working and waiting for more marshmallows can be the unwise choice. When the world is full of uncontrolled inflation, bank failures, and promised future payoffs that never deliver, there are good objective reasons to ring the bell and refuse to wait. And the subjective reasons are just as compelling. In the extreme, delay of gratification becomes stifling. A joyless, driven life of postponed pleasures, happy diversions not taken, emotions not experienced, possible lives unlived. We are both ants and grasshoppers, and to lose the hot emotional system and live continually dominated by the cool cognitive system in the service of a possible future can become a life story as unsatisfying as its opposite. When do we feel entitled to behave more like grasshoppers than like future-oriented ants, constantly busy with work? When do we allow ourselves to relax, let the hot system take over, self-reward with our viscerally preferred personal marshmallows, and forget the unanswered emails and tomorrow's to-do list? What determines our willingness to let ourselves have the pleasure of doing nothing, the unscheduled weekend at the beach, the trip to the big city, or just time off at home to celebrate life? We may not need to act as stupidly as some of those fallen heroes in the headlines, but we all do seem to have implicit rules about when we suspend self-control and let ourselves enjoy the fun thing now, or instead postpone those pleasures and keep pushing on for more and bigger rewards in the future. How do we develop those rules? Answers to these questions have direct implications for how we raise our children and how we treat ourselves. Today, upper-middle-class American parents supposedly live child-centered lives, rushing home from work to assure maximum quality time devoted to the kids, showering them with affection and rewards, letting them lead the way. They can often be seen allowing their children to have unchecked screaming fits because it takes a few minutes for their hamburger to arrive at McDonald's. In contrast, French parenting is reputed to raise preschoolers who can be taken to elegant restaurants in Paris where they ostensibly sit quietly and wait for their entrecote with haricot vert, while their parents enjoy an apéritif. To raise ideal kids, one Chinese-American mother offers a long list of what should be forbidden, including sleepovers, playdates, TV, computer games, and any grade lower than A. That is the formula in 2011 that Amy Chua proposed in her Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother to raise a child who's likely to excel at playing either the violin or the piano and be number one in every class, with the possible exception of gym. A dozen years earlier, Judith Rich Harris argued that parenting of any kind does not really matter anyway, because socialization by peers and genetics are the two key factors that shape children's lives. To go beyond anecdotes and personal opinions, we would have to conduct experiments that carefully manipulate what happens under different parenting conditions in real life. But such studies cannot be done. We can ask and answer questions relevant to parenting practices, however, by doing short-term experiments with adult models under realistic conditions that are meaningful to children. My interest in this area began when my children were attending elementary school and brought home their proudest early achievements, like the blue and black flip-flop sandal made out of baked clay by my youngest daughter. This led me into a series of studies to see how we set standards for our own accomplishments starting early in life, and how we do or don't reward ourselves when those standards are met. The questions became, what are the socializing experiences and the implicit rules that guide this form of self-reward and self-regulation? When do children develop will fatigue and decide that it is time to congratulate themselves, indulge a bit, and reward themselves? When do they persist and delay gratification until they meet more stringent standards? Or does the continuing effort itself become the pleasure? Modeling self-standards. Because models profoundly influence who we become, I was eager to study how they guide the standards we develop for evaluating and regulating ourselves beginning in childhood. The characteristics and behaviors of adult models influence what young children learn, imitate, and transmit to others. At Stanford, concurrent with the marshmallow studies, my students and I began to do experiments to see how children acquired their self-standards. In these studies, we varied the model's attributes and self-reward behavior to see how they influenced what young children incorporated into their own standards when the adult left the room. My student Robert Liebert and I selected fourth-grade boys and girls, mostly 10-year-olds, from local elementary schools near Stanford. In individual sessions, we introduced each child to a young woman, the model, who showed him or her a sort of bowling game that a toy company was ostensibly testing to see how much children liked it. It was a miniature 3-foot-long version of a bowling alley with signal lights at the end that registered the score for each trial. The target area at the end of the runway was screened so that the bowler could not see where the ball hit and relied on the score displayed in signal lights for feedback. These scores were preset and not connected to actual performance, but in a way that made them completely credible. Within easy arm's reach was a large bowl full of tokens, colorful poker chips that the child and the model could use to reward themselves for their performance. They were told that the chips were worth valuable prizes at the end, and the more chips, the better the prize. The attractively wrapped prizes were in full view in the room, but were not discussed. Do as I say or do as I do. To play the game, the model and the child took turns, one trial at a time. In order to simulate different parenting styles, we created 3 different scenarios for how the model rewarded her own performance and how she guided the child to evaluate and reward his own performance. Each child participated in only one of these conditions. In the tough standards scenario, the model was stringent with herself and equally stringent with the child. She took a token only when her score was very high, 20. Making self-approving comments like, that's a good score, that deserves a chip, or I can be proud of that score, I should treat myself for that. Whenever her score was lower than 20, she refrained from taking a token and criticized herself. For example, that's not a very good score, that doesn't deserve a chip. She treated the child's performance in a directly parallel way, praising the high scores but remaining critical of lower scores. In the tough-on-model, easy-on-child script, the model was tough on herself, but lenient with the child, leading him to self-reward for lower scores. In the easy-on-model, tough-on-child scenario, she was lenient with herself, but held the child to a stringent standard of self-rewarding for only the best score. After the children participated in one of these conditions, we unobtrusively observed their spontaneous self-reward behavior when they bowled alone in the post-test in which the tokens remained freely available. Children adopted the most stringent standards for self-reward when they had learned from a tough-on-herself model who was equally tough on them. This model encouraged them to reward themselves only for top scores and held herself to the same standard. When the modeled and the imposed standards were consistent, children adopted those standards without a single deviation in the model's absence, in spite of the stringency of the criterion and the desirability of the rewards. The research also showed that these effects were especially strong when children believed that the model was powerful and had control over many highly desirable treats and rewards. Children who were encouraged to be lenient with themselves remained that way in the post-test when they were left on their own, even if they had observed a model who was stringent with herself. In the group of children who were held to a stringent self-reward standard during training, but had learned from a model who was lenient with herself, half retained the more stringent standards that had been taught, and half used the more liberal standards they had observed the model use for herself. This study suggests that if you want your children to adopt high self-reward standards, it's a good idea to guide them to adopt those standards and also model them in your own behavior. If you aren't consistent and are tough on your children but lenient with yourself, there's a good chance they'll adopt the self-reward standards you modeled, not the ones you imposed on them. Motivation and effort. The Green Team. If we step outside the laboratory, we can look at the psychological conditions and human qualities that motivate people to push themselves to the extremes of self-control. A prime example being the United States Navy SEALs. In his 2012 autobiography, Mark Owen, a pseudonym, describes the raid in which he and his teammates killed Osama bin Laden. And it is a thriller that goes beyond the excitement of the raid to the motivations and training that help shape individuals like Mark to defy will fatigue. Mark was the child of missionary parents in Alaska. In junior high school, he opened Men in Green Faces, a book by a former SEAL. It depicted the SEAL firefights and ambushes in Vietnam's Mekong Delta, particularly focusing on their hunt for a rogue North Vietnamese colonel. Mark was captivated from the first page, immediately sure he wanted to be a SEAL. The more I read, the more I wanted to see if I could measure up. In the surf of the Pacific Ocean during training, I found other men just like me. Men who feared failure and were driven to be the best. I was privileged to serve with and be inspired by these men every day. SEAL training was brutal, involving endless long runs in freezing temperatures or desert heat, extreme physical challenges like pushing cars and buses, and searching and shooting in kill houses under realistic and endlessly unpredictable battle conditions. For people like Mark, reaching the 100th pull-up became the signal for raising the bar and making the next 30 the goal. Beating their own personal best became the moving target, the self-standard that they always tried to exceed, not the signal to feel fatigue and let themselves quit. In a program in which 75% of the men in each class failed to complete training, Mark finally made it to the Green Team. The last step toward becoming prepared and selected, maybe, for the elite Navy SEAL Team 6, which conducts the most dangerous and difficult hunt and kill missions. If selected, Mark would fulfill his burning lifelong goal. Mark's experiences and triumphs illustrate the importance of an implicit theory of willpower that is open to virtually limitless development, combined with burning goals that fuel and sustain effort and grit, and a social environment that provides inspiring models and support. All of these play into the relentless training and self-discipline needed to become truly exceptional. Whether the goal is to play Bach at Carnegie Hall, win the Nobel Prize in Physics, gather gold medals at the Olympics, move from poverty in the South Bronx to Yale University, become a Navy SEAL, or, in the preschool version, collect marshmallows, when 15 minutes feels like a lifetime. Part 3. From Lab to Life. I began Part 1 with the story of the marshmallow test and the experiments that revealed the strategies preschoolers used to control themselves. Part 2 showed that the same strategies also empower adults to postpone pleasures to save for their retirement. In Part 2, I also illustrated that the same mechanisms underlying successful control strategies help heartbroken people overcome their pain, rejection-sensitive individuals preserve their relationships, and exhausted Navy SEALs do even more pull-ups. Taken together, what has been discovered about mastering self-control leads to several key conclusions. 1. Least surprising, some people are better than others in their ability to resist temptations and to regulate painful emotions. 2. More surprising, these differences become visible as early as in the preschool years, are stable over time for most but not all people, and predict highly consequential psychological and biological outcomes over the course of life. 3. The traditional belief that willpower is an inborn trait that you either have a lot of or you don't, but cannot do much about it either way, is false. Instead, self-control skills, both cognitive and emotional, can be learned, enhanced, and harnessed so that they become automatically activated when you need them. This is easier for some people because emotionally hot rewards and temptations are not as hot for them, and they also more readily cool them. But no matter how good or bad we are at self-control naturally, we can improve our self-control skills and help our children do the same. Moreover, we can fail to develop our self-control skills, and even if we have them in abundance, we may lack the goals, values, and social support needed to use them constructively. 4. We don't have to be the victims of our social and biological histories. Self-control skills can protect us against our own vulnerabilities. They may not eliminate these vulnerabilities completely, but they can help us function better with them. For example, an individual with high rejection sensitivity who also has good self-control is better able to protect the very relationships that he fears he will lose. 5. Self-control involves more than determination. It requires strategies and insights, as well as goals and motivation, to make willpower easier to develop and persistence, often called grit, rewarding in its own right. In part 3, I turn from the lab to life, looking first at how these findings speak directly to public policy. Then I summarize and illustrate the core strategies that can make willpower in daily life less effortful and more natural for our children and ourselves. In the final chapter, Human Nature, I discuss how the research about self-control and the plasticity of the human brain changes the conception of who we are. 18. Marshmallows and Public Policy. Many years ago, when I was a student in the clinical psychology graduate program at the City College of New York, I worked as an uncredentialed social worker with groups of economically impoverished children and adolescents. I met with them at the Henry Street Settlement, an agency in the slums, as they were then called, of the Lower East Side of Manhattan. I was intrigued by the classic clinical psychology theories and methods I was learning at school and was eager to apply them in my social work. One evening at Henry Street, I was surrounded by a group of adolescent boys who listened while I tried to use my new insights to interpret the anger of a particularly hostile youngster, a boy whose older brother was awaiting execution in the state prison's death row. The kids seemed particularly attentive and eager to learn more, but I soon smelled smoke and saw that the back of my jacket had been set on fire by one of the boys behind me. After putting it out, I recognized that the fascinating clinical methods and concepts I was being taught were irrelevant, to say the least, to the young people I was supposed to help. This insight was one of the steps that led me to a research career, as I hope to find more effective ways to help kids like those at Henry Street make the most of their lives. Half a century later, I started to hear from educators who were trying to apply the findings from research on self-control and delay of gratification to the immense challenges they were facing as the gap kept widening between those at the top of the economic and achievement ladder in the United States and those at the bottom. While much public education continues to deteriorate, it is always encouraging to meet dedicated and creative educational leaders who are crafting alternatives. It's a privilege to glimpse what they're doing, learn of the innovations they're trying, and see their successes, frustrations, and challenges. Their commitment to nurturing the qualities essential for success in their students, and their eagerness to try to apply the research findings in their daily efforts, helped motivate me to write this book. In this chapter, I look at how the discoveries from the research on self-control can be incorporated into educational interventions and the resulting implications for public policy. Plasticity, the educable human brain. A silent revolution in the conception of human nature has been slowly building momentum over the past two decades as scientists revealed the plasticity of the human brain. The unexpected finding is that there is great malleability in the areas of the prefrontal cortex that enable executive function. As discussed throughout this book, these mechanisms allow us to cool and restrain our impulsive hot reactions in the service of our goals and values, and to regulate emotions adaptively. The importance of executive function, EF, for how lives play out, and specifically for our ability to overcome stimulus control with self-control, is undisputed. The public policy implications that follow depend on whether or not we think that EF skills and the potential for self-control are essentially pre-wired and fixed. If they are, there's little that interventions can do. But if they are malleable, the public policy implications are profound and call for educational efforts to target the enhancement of these skills as early in life as possible. We know today that when a preschooler manages to wait for her two marshmallows, the anterior cingulate and lateral prefrontal areas of her brain must activate strongly. These areas are key parts of the cool cognitive system she needs to control the impulsiveness of her emotional hot system. Imaging with fMRI was still decades away when I was watching the children through the observation window. And back then I could not begin to imagine what went on in their brains as they sat facing their treats in the surprise room. Well-controlled laboratory interventions since then reveal that direct training of EF yields not just improvements in self-control, but also changes in the corresponding neural functions in the brain. In 2005, a research team under the leadership of Michael Posner conducted experiments to show how training and genetics jointly influence the cognitive and attention control skills that let preschoolers cool their hot systems. The researchers exposed children aged 4 to 6 to a 40-minute attention training session each day for 5 days. In these sessions, the children played a variety of computer games designed to tap and enhance different aspects of their attention control ability. In particular, the ability to keep a goal in mind and shift their attention to pursue it while inhibiting interfering impulses. In one game, for example, they used a joystick to track a cartoon cat on the computer screen. Their job was to move the cat to a grassy area and avoid the muddy areas, which kept getting bigger while the grassy areas began to shrink, making their task increasingly difficult. The question that the researchers were trying to answer was, will such training experience influence the children's attention control scores later on a different standard test of attention control? Their attention control did improve significantly when compared to a no-training control group, an encouraging finding given the simplicity and short duration of the training. Most surprising was that even this brief training period served to improve scores on nonverbal measures of intelligence. The same group of researchers went on to find in related studies that specific genes that influence the child's ability to cool and control negative emotions and reduce hyperactivity also influence attention and self-control ability. The DAT1 gene in particular has a role in various dopamine-related disorders, including ADHD, bipolar disorder, clinical depression, and alcoholism. The promising news for public policy is that the researchers discovered that even in people with the genetic vulnerability, attention control can be enhanced significantly by interventions, specifically through better education and parenting techniques during development. It is nature and nurture seamlessly influencing each other. Given the importance of EF for developing social as well as cognitive skills and self-control, it is good to see the research by Adele Diamond at the University of British Columbia that tests to determine if EF is in fact malleable and teachable in simple educational interventions in preschool. In 2007, Diamond and her colleagues reported the results of one of her largest studies in the journal Science. Their Tools of the Mind curriculum, designed to enhance EF development, exposed preschoolers' average age of 5.1 years intensively and daily to 40 EF-promoting activities. These ranged from game-like exercises in which the child tells herself what she should do, to dramatic play, to practicing simple tasks that improve memory, to learning to focus and control attention purposefully. Diamond studies were conducted in more than 20 classrooms in a low-income school district, and they compared the effects of Tools of the Mind on EF competencies with the effects of the standard balanced literacy curriculum of the school district, which covered similar academic content but did not address EF development. To rule out possible differences in teacher qualities, all the classrooms received identical resources and were staffed by teachers with equal amounts of training and support. Likewise, all the children came from the same neighborhood, were randomly assigned to the two programs, and were similar in age and background. In their second year of preschool, when children in the two programs were compared on the standard cognitive and neural tests of EF, the Tools curriculum was the winner by a substantial margin, and it was the most effective for the children who had begun with the lowest levels of EF. Indeed, the children's progress in the Tools program was so impressive that after the first year, the educators in one of the schools insisted on ending the experiment so that the children in the control group who had been receiving the standard balanced literacy curriculum could also participate in the Tools program. The opportunity to influence EF development through interventions is not limited to the preschool years. At age 11 to 12 years, with just a few hours of training, children who are underperforming in school were helped to use specific if-then implementation plans and strategies to significantly improve their schoolwork, grade point average, attendance, and conduct. In another study, children with ADHD went through 5 weeks of training to improve their working memory, the memory needed to briefly retain information, like a 7-digit phone number you hear and are trying to keep in mind long enough to dial. Working memory is a crucial component of EF that is required for goal pursuit. This training not only improved their working memory, but also reduced their ADHD symptoms and problematic behaviors. Simple meditation and mindfulness exercises can also substantially improve executive function. Mindfulness training helps individuals achieve a present-centered, concentrated attention. You let yourself effortlessly become aware of each feeling, sensation, or thought that arises, accepting and acknowledging whatever you experience, non-judgmentally and without elaboration. In one group of young adults who had 5 days of training for about 20 minutes a day, these exercises, along with brief meditation, decreased negative effect, eased fatigue, and reduced psychological and physiological responses to stress when compared with a control group that spent the same amount of time doing standard relaxation training. Mindfulness training also reduced distracting thoughts, facilitated concentration, and improved performance in college students on standardized tests like the graduate record examination, used by many graduate schools in the United States as an admission requirement. Likewise, the normal adult and aging brain can benefit from relatively simple interventions to enhance EF. Two of the most notable are physical exercise, even in moderate amounts and over short time periods, and virtually anything that minimizes loneliness, provides social support, and strengthens the individual's ties and connectedness to other people. Implications: a science consensus on public policy. In short, it has become clear that effective interventions are available to enhance EF. According to the National Scientific Council on the Developing Child, the public policy implications are equally clear. This council consists of a group of respected scientists who have been studying the toxic effects of chronic stress, which typically characterizes the lives of children who live in extreme poverty. They've also examined the interventions that have the potential to substantially reduce those stress levels. In 2011, they reached an unambiguous consensus. Strong executive function is crucial for children to build lives that let them develop to their full potential. In light of rapidly growing and convincing evidence, quote, that these capacities can be improved through focused early intervention programs, efforts to support the development of these skills deserve much greater attention in the design of early care and education programs, close quote. As far as Science Board recommendations go, this message is as passionate and urgent a call to action as it gets. Their conclusions stick closely to the data from the best research and avoid any trace of emotion, which may be why their recommendations too often remain mostly buried in the research archives, with nods of approval from other researchers, or in occasional opinion pieces in the media that cheer them on. The editorials add the passion, and duly note that the vast achievement gap in our society is heartbreaking and life-destroying to those who live at the bottom and are the subjects of this research. There are countless preschool-age kids who do not know the difference between a book's front cover and its back cover, as one pundit put it, who live without ever being told stories or having their imaginations stirred, who hear and have few conversations, who walk hungry to poor schools through dangerous streets, and who return to homes filled with the blaring TV or broken family fighting. High stress is chronic in these children. Seeing the magnitude of this reality, caring innovators are working hard to make the scientists' messages and recommendations come alive. Many are trying to incorporate what has been learned in the research about self-control, resistance to temptation, and brain development into educational curriculum. Some of these efforts are shaking up how educators are thinking about their programs as they try to make education for self-discipline and emotional well-being more effective, beginning with preschoolers. Socializing Cookie Monster. One of the best-known efforts designed by innovators in early childhood education is Sesame Street, the educational preschool series produced by Sesame Workshop. The program airs worldwide and is aimed at educating and entertaining preschoolers. I have recently had the privilege and pleasure of consulting with the outstanding education and research group at Sesame Workshop on how to model self-control skills by trying to socialize Cookie Monster. I emphasize try to socialize him because Cookie Monster definitely has a mind of his own. He personifies untamed visceral desire specifically for cookies, preferably chocolate chip. He is driven by a hot system only loosely connected to a still primitive prefrontal cortex that seems devoted mostly to assisting him in his search for more cookies, with little interest in helping him inhibit his very hot cookie-specific impulses. This wide-eyed, impulsive blue character has an undisciplined, assertive, extroverted personality. Loudly and proudly announcing, "Me want cookie, me eat cookie," he proceeds to devour any cookie that is within reach. In its 43rd and 44th seasons, Sesame Street sets out a challenge for him: to control his unbridled impulses by cooling his hot system so that he can gain entry into the refined and exclusive Cookie Connoisseurs Club. Preschoolers learn lessons from watching him that illustrate how the findings on self-control can inform and guide the contents and educational mission of preschool programs. In one segment, Cookie Monster appears on screen as a game show contestant. In the background, an island-style limbo band sings, "Good things come to those who wait." The congenial but firm game show host asks Cookie Monster if he is ready to play the waiting game. Cookie Monster:
"Waiting game. Oh boy, imagine me luck, me get to play waiting game. What waiting game?"
Host: "The game where we give you a cookie." A cookie on an easel rises into view. Cookie Monster:
"Oh boy, me love this game. Cookie,
Cookie Monster rushes to devour it, but the host grabs it away. Host: "Wait, Cookie Monster."
"Wait to eat cookie? That crazy talk. Why me wait?"
Host: "Because this is the waiting game, and if you wait to eat the cookie until I get back, you get two cookies." The lesson proceeds as the host patiently explains the rules again. If you wait for the cookie till I get back, you get two cookies. For about a second, Cookie Monster thinks it's a good idea.
"Me wait then."
and then the host wishes him good luck. But Cookie Monster quickly has a hot insight.
Oh, who me kidding? Me can't wait. Me have cookie now.
And lunges for it, intercepted by the waiting game singers who pop up singing, "Good things come to those who wait." Singers explain that singing is a good strategy to use when it's really hard to wait for something. And Cookie Monster tries, but can't, and doesn't want to.
Forget it. Me just eat it.
The singers intervene again. You need another strategy. Remember, good things come to those who wait. Yeah, good things come to those who wait. The lesson continues as Cookie Monster learns to pretend the cookies are in a frame, traces a mental frame with his fingers, pulls out a real picture frame and frames the cookie with it, twiddles his thumbs, hums dum-de-dum, but soon becomes tempted again. He keeps getting support as he learns new strategies step by step, and is amazed as he begins to discover some by himself.
Me need another strategy. Ah, got it. Me take me mind off cookie by playing with this toy.
He brings up a stuffed dog and begins to sing to himself and play with it, until that gets boring and he invents a new way to keep going.
Me pretend delicious cookie is a very smelly fish.
As the cookie is transformed into a fish on the easel and he waits, waving the air around as if smelling a stinky odor. In time, lots of time, after much effort and with increasing grit, he wins the waiting game and joins in the music, singing triumphantly, "Good things come to those who wait." This episode is one of many in the 2 years of programming that Sesame Workshop is devoting to self-regulation. Its 2013 and 2014 seasons of Sesame Street provide memorable, entertaining lessons about the diverse forms of self-regulation conveyed in the antics and adventures of its adorable and long-beloved characters, from Cookie Monster to Oscar the Grouch and his garbage can. They engage preschoolers in funny, short stories while teaching some of the most essential aspects of self-control and a host of other strategies and skills preschoolers need to begin to develop executive function, self-restraint, and the regulation of their own emotions. The Sesame Street education researchers have made many efforts to objectively assess the impact of their programs, and they've gathered evidence over the years documenting their program's connection to many positive outcomes, including greater school readiness and success. Although kids who watch more Sesame Street do better, we cannot know if that's because of what the program teaches or because they are children whose parents are more likely to turn the television to educational programming. Most likely, both factors contribute to making these programs useful, and not just for keeping children busy and happy, but for helping them develop skills and learn important social, moral, and cognitive life lessons. From Cookie Monster to Kip Schools. Leading scientists who worry about the effects of toxic stress on the infant's brain and on subsequent susceptibility to mental and physical illness note that those who are lowest in socioeconomic status, SES, have greater morbidity and mortality for diverse diseases and suffer from what has been named the biology of disadvantage, or the physiological and psychological consequences of living under chronic stress beginning at conception. For educators who work with people at the very low end of the SES scale, the challenge is how to help children, parents, and caregivers overcome that disadvantage. The most promising route is to provide access to education as early in life as possible, which in turn can help them climb up the SES ladder. But what kind of education, and with what methods? The depressing state of public school education in the United States, particularly in impoverished school districts, has received widespread attention. The encouraging news in an overall grim picture is that in the past 10 years or so, and with accelerating speed, diverse innovative educational interventions are being developed to try to incorporate what has been learned about brain development, delay of gratification, self-control, and self-discipline into curricula. Many of these ventures are working to make education more effective in different types of school settings, particularly those that children with the biology of disadvantage generally attend. Here, I focus on one promising effort that closely connects what it teaches to findings at the cutting edge of psychological science, the KIPP school programs in New York City, which helped George Ramirez find his way. In the fall of 2012, I visited four of the nine KIPP Academy schools then in New York City, with a tenth under construction. That KIPP stands for the Knowledge is Power program is proudly announced on signs throughout its schools. I went to glimpse how the program was faring in the real world as it tried to educate children living in some of the poorest SES areas of the country. My goal was to get a sense of what was possible in this kind of school. KIPP is becoming a model for different kinds of efforts to transform public education. My introduction came from Dave Levin, the seemingly inexhaustible 40-something engine that's driving the KIPP group of charter schools. These schools are devoted to preparing children starting in kindergarten for college, and college banners hang all over their classroom walls. More than 86% of the students are inner-city minority children from impoverished backgrounds. They arrive at 7:30 a.m. and are dismissed at 4:30 or 5 p.m. In the summer, there are 2 to 3 weeks of additional school. Parent participation and parental visits are encouraged in many programs. The children are selected by lottery since there are not nearly enough places for the many who want and deserve a chance. The New York City KIPP schools are modeled on a program that Dave Levin and Mike Feinberg started in one fifth-grade classroom in Houston, Texas in 1994. In 2014, there will be 141 KIPP schools nationwide with about 50,000 K-12 students. One of the schools I visited, KIPP Infinity Elementary School, is located in the predominantly Hispanic and African-American neighborhood of Harlem in Manhattan, a few blocks north of Columbia University and south of the City College of New York. This KIPP school opened in 2010. And has about 300 students from kindergarten to fourth grade, of whom more than 90% are African American or Hispanic, and about the same percent qualify for the free or reduced cost lunch program available to low-income families. The school is exceptionally attractive, sparkling clean, and well-lit, with comfortable modern furnishings and equipment. Having attended New York City public schools when I was a child and visited them for research in recent years, I found the contrast in appearance alone a happy surprise. When I wandered into a first-grade classroom, I saw kids attentively listening as their young teacher spoke quietly with them. I was approached and greeted immediately by Malcolm, a little boy with a soft voice and gentle manner, who politely introduced himself. While extending his hand for a warm handshake, Malcolm asked my name and welcomed me to the classroom, the Columbia University Lions. As he ushered me in, loud drum rolls and lots of cheering erupted as the teacher announced who had been selected for name day that morning, not because of a birthday, but a sweet, enthusiastic celebration of a different child every day. Each classroom is named for a different college and has banners with inspirational themes hanging on the walls that are discussed repeatedly. UNITE, for example, is the acronym for Understand, Never Give Up, Imagine, Take a Risk, Explore. A recovery chair or thinking chair sits in one area of the room, not for the standing in the corner punishment of earlier times, but to help students cool down when they feel that they're about to lose it, or for when the teacher believes that's about to happen. The area around the chair includes a timer with sand flowing through and messages displayed on the nearby wall to help the child self-soothe, get distance from a hot situation, breathe deeply, count backward, imagine anger floating away in helium balloons, and other strategies for calming down, regaining control, and going from feeling hot to thinking cool, so that she can leave the chair and return to rejoin the class. Madeline, age 10, was in the fifth grade, nearing the end of her first year at KIPP when I met her. She had moved to KIPP from the public school on the other side of the building. Over there it was more cold, Madeline said about the public school, and here the teachers are more strict with more expectations that you have to follow. Her enthusiasm kept spilling out. I think I'm learning differently. The teachers are clearer. Each day we learn new and review the old. Here we take school more seriously. More homework, review more, get reports on how we're doing. Progress reports. You still have a chance of changing it if you attend better, behave better. A report card is just a final grade. What will she be doing when she's 20 years old? She'll be a doctor or a vet or a teacher, she said. How will she get there? She answered thoughtfully, slowly, with many details and examples from the more I listen, the more I learn, to spending 3 hours on homework each night, to reflecting on herself and how she was changing. I'm learning more, becoming a more hardworking person. We have 90 minutes in each class and learn something new every day. What's social intelligence? I asked her. Her answer? Like when something falls and you pick it up before you're told. It's when you think ahead before someone tells you. If someone is behaving badly in class, you don't listen to them. What is self-control? It's similar to social intelligence. Even though someone is doing something that's funny in class, you don't laugh. You have to control yourself. If you want to take something you want, you control yourself and don't. She reminded me of the answer I got from another child the same age who was struggling to gain better self-control. It's thinking before doing, he had patiently explained. As a researcher, I know I can't generalize from a small sample. I realize that I have to be cautious not to reach hasty conclusions from very thin slices of behavior, and I must temper my impressions with caveats. But I also know that wandering through KIPP classrooms, meeting these children, and catching glimpses of how they listen and speak, as well as how the teachers teach, left me feeling a lot more optimistic about the future for at-risk children. I felt more than a warm glow. My cool system saw that when wisely applied by dedicated teachers in the right classroom environment, the lessons learned in the lab could give these children the chance to change their lives, discover their goals, and work hard to progress toward them. KIPP exemplifies an educational philosophy and school system that is incorporating research findings into its daily curriculum and way of life. It is demonstrating that self-control can be nurtured, goal-setting, encouraged, realistic goals achieved, curiosity stimulated, and persistence rewarded until grit becomes its own reward. I asked Dave Levin if KIPP schools really save lives, to use George Ramirez's phrase. Dave was adamant that they don't save anybody's life. He insisted, quote, "We're the cheerleaders. The kids are playing the game. They do the heavy lifting. We set up the conditions. The hard work has to be done by each individual." Close quote. KIPP's mission, he explained, is to help children have choice-filled lives. Choice does not mean one road for all, and it does not have to mean an Ivy League college or even college at all. Choice is about children having genuine options in how they make their lives, regardless of their demographics. Building character skills. Dave and I talk often about how he thinks KIPP needs to evolve to be even more effective and how it is changing. In the 1990s, when KIPP began, college and the academic training required to get there seemed to be the passport out of toxic poverty and into a world of opportunities and choices. Therefore, KIPP's overarching goal was and remains to do whatever it takes to get its students to complete college. Dave tells me that in 2013, about 3,200 KIPP graduates were in college with a cumulative college completion rate of about 40%. This compares with a rate of 8 to 10% for children of similar backgrounds who are not in KIPP programs, and the United States national average college graduation rate of 32%. Dave believes that this success rate reflects the fact that KIPP students not only learn academic skills required for college, but are also taught the character skills necessary to thrive there and beyond. For him, the continuing challenge is how to most effectively build character education into the KIPP curriculum. I was worried when he first mentioned character because so often the term is used for inborn traits. But that is not what it means in these schools. Instead, character is viewed as a set of teachable skills, specific behaviors and attitudes. Most important, self-control. But also such qualities as grit, optimism, curiosity, and zest. Hip schools are trying to make character education